Well, in 2004, Andy Marceau was a self-described normal college student getting ready to graduate from KU. One night, he went to bed thinking he had the flu. The next morning, he couldn't get out of bed. The next evening, he was in critical condition fighting bacterial meningitis. 3 weeks later, Andy Marceau woke up from a drug-induced coma to find out that his fingers and toes were dying. What followed was 3 months of painful treatment to save them. Andy Marceau is a reporter at the Topeka Capital Journal covering state government, and he's written a book about his experiences. That book, Worth the Pain, How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed Me for the Better. And Andy Marceau joins us now here in the studios, and so good to have you, Andy. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on, Steve.
You suffer from meningitis B, which is bacterial meningitis. How is that different from any other kind of meningitis?
Well, there's two main types. There's viral and bacterial. And yeah. Viral is more common, but it's far less serious. It's obviously caused by a virus, so it's not, you know, treatable with antibiotics. So usually if you have viral meningitis, you'll feel ill for a few weeks. It's not going to be fun, but you're usually not going to die of it. Now, bacterial meningitis is a whole other ballgame. Bacterial meningitis is the one where it can take a healthy person, healthy young person, and within 24 hours it can kill them.
It does that how? What's going on?
Well, usually the bacteria lives in people's throats. About 10-15% of the population will carry it around at any given time, and it's totally harmless. In some cases, and doctors aren't really sure why, it'll find a person at the wrong time, and it'll get into their spinal fluid, and that's where you get the term spinal meningitis. It tends to multiply in there, and you can have a fulminant infection that will either go up and affect your brain, and you can end up with brain damage and hearing loss, vision loss, or in some cases, like it did with me, it gets in the bloodstream, and it causes what's called a septic infection. When that bacteria is just, with every pump of your heart, it's spreading that bacteria through your whole body, and that's why it works so fast and, you know, is so deadly.
So you went to bed one night thinking you had the flu. You woke up the next morning. This was in 2004, and then kablam, right? I mean, here...
Yeah, my life changed overnight. No question about it. I, you know, night before, flu-like symptoms. By the next morning, I tried to walk and my feet hurt so bad. I literally could not put weight on my feet. And I also had this strange purple rash on my arms, which I later found out was just thousands of tiny bruises where that bacteria was slicing holes in my blood vessels and the blood was pooling in my soft tissue. And that's how I ended up losing parts of my limbs because I lost circulation. I lost blood flow to my fingers and toes.
And so for you, the consequence of having this has turned out to be what?
Well, I lost the front half of both of my feet. I lost all of my fingers except my right thumb. And I have really severe scarring and skin grafting basically covering my arms and legs. And so I need to wear braces to walk. I've got a prosthetic toe filler and then a brace that comes up to almost to my knees. So that's my routine now. Is first thing when I wake up in the morning, I strap those on so that I can get out of bed. But really, you know, I've in the nine and a half years since then, I've been able to get back, you know, 95, 96% of what I used to do.
I got to tell you, I watched the video of you promoting your new book, again, Worth the Pain, How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed Me for the Better. And there's a few images on that video that are pretty tough to look at. Can you believe it's you when you look at it now, Andy?
No, I mean, when I look back at all those pictures, and we have hundreds of pictures that we took for purposes of insurance to show the insurance company that we were billing, you know, yes, this is
serious.
Yeah. It is hard to believe, but it was such a long process to kind of get over that. You know, when I was going through that, those they call it the tank room, which is where they take you to start scraping away all that dead tissue. And it was very, very hard to get through that. And then I had nightmares about it for years afterwards.
Nightmares about what exactly?
About being in that tank room and watching, you know, doctors, nurses, wound techs take a scalpel to that dead skin and just seeing that dead skin attached to me. I had nightmares about it. And what really ended the nightmares, honestly, was writing the book, was getting it all down on paper. And the first draft of the book actually had a lot more of that in there, and we had to take it out because it was just a little bit too much for readers, I think.
So it's funny the effect, that the good effect that can have just talking about it, getting out. Just a couple of days ago, sitting in your chair, Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who leaped on the back of Kennedy's car on that day in Dallas, and who that man suffered with those images and what happened to that day for decades. And it wasn't until 1990, he goes to Dallas and walks the land again and saw what happened, and he began to talk about that. He could finally come to grips with it, and it sounds like that's what happened with you too.
Very similar with me. I mean, when I was writing this, there was days when I was sitting in my room just sobbing and weeping. But it was cathartic to get all of this out, and it helped me process the experience. And actually, the theme of the book, Worth the Pain, it didn't emerge until after that first draft was done, and I'd really been able to process the experience and figure out, for everything that I went through, it made me so much stronger. It made my relationships with my family and friends so much closer. And that so that in the end, it really was worth it, which at the time, there's no way I would have thought that that was possible.
That's so interesting to hear that, because you've said that you were completely unprepared for what hit you, Andy, that you'd been sheltered and pampered, and you were mentally weak and untested, you even said, and that if you could deal with this, anybody could. Why did you say that? Because I've got to tell you, watching the video, I'm wondering if I could deal with it,
Yeah. I grew up kind of the classic suburban kid,
Yeah.
I mean, two loving parents who supported me and were always there for me. So anytime I had a problem, I could just kind of pass it off to them and they take care of it.
Flip the switch and there they were.
Exactly. Yeah. And in this case, they were there for me every day, but this was something I had to do on my own. They couldn't take this pain away. As much as they wanted to, they couldn't be in that tank room going through it. I had to face it. Finally, there was a test that I had to face and see if I could overcome it. And there were so many nights when I laid in bed and thought, this is unbearable. I can't do it. I cannot get up and face this another day. And then the sun would come up and somehow I would find the strength. So that's part of the book, obviously, was to raise awareness about meningitis. But I also wanted to just tell a story that inspires people who are feeling like they're going through something that they just cannot bear and show them, look, it does get better.
We're talking with Andy Marceau about his battle with bacterial meningitis. Again, his new book, Worth the Pain, How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed Me for the Better. We have a doctor on the line here from Leawood who wants to talk about two or three different types of bacterial meningitis. Ben, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Morning. I would just like to explain that the kind of bacterial meningitis that he had was caused by an organism called Neisseria meningitidis, and it's well known to have a rapid onset and a rapid course in the matter of hours a patient can be dead. The second kind of meningitis, at least in children, is called Haemophilus influenzae. It's a bacterial meningitis. It's just about gone, thank goodness, due to immunizations. We don't yet immunize children routinely against Neisseria meningitidis, but Haemophilus influenzae has been completely gone. Then there's some they're not minor, but they're not nearly as frequent, Staphylococcus and the pneumococcus. Now, the pneumococcus, again, it's a bacterial. It has decreased significantly with the vaccine. There's a vaccine for invasive disease, pneumococcal invasive disease, and that has markedly decreased the cases. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, Ben, I'm glad you called. Thank you. And that leads me into a conversation about the big news right now is that UC Santa Barbara and Princeton had nearly simultaneous outbreaks of meningitis B. What do we know about how widespread this was, Andy?
Well, we know that there's been 8 cases at Princeton since March, and 7 of them were students. One of them was someone who was visiting the campus, a prospective student. 4 cases at UCSB in that same timeline. And this is really just extremely rare. Even to have one outbreak of the magnitude that Princeton is seeing with 8 cases would be rare. To have, 2 outbreaks with 4 or more cases at the same time is almost unheard of.
And what's the theory about why this is happening?
Well, it's just probably a strange, crazy coincidence. But one reason that they're both probably men B is that a lot of colleges now, including KU, because of what happened to me, require the current vaccines for Neisseria meningitidis, like the doctor said. And so that's done a good job of kind of tamping that down on most college campuses. The current vaccines don't cover meningitis B, the serogroup that I had, the serogroup that's ravaging Princeton and UCSB right now. So if we're going to see outbreaks like this on college campuses, like Princeton, I know, requires vaccination. So those kids are not going to get the other serogroups. It's going to be B. There is a meningitis B vaccine that's been approved in Europe and Australia.
But we can't get it here, though, right? And you've been out there talking about this.
I've been talking about it as much as I can. I've been tweeting about it. I've been tweeting rather graphic pictures at the FDA trying to get their attention because Princeton is getting meningitis B this week. Monday was the first day that anyone has ever been vaccinated for meningitis B on U.S. soil.
Well, how do they get it if it's not if the FDA hasn't signed off on
they
it?
They basically got a special dispensation from the FDA.
They've got some political pull at Princeton, right? That's the deal.
Yeah, and the other strange thing is that they're getting it for free. Somebody is bankrolling it so that everybody, you know, all the undergrads and all the graduate students who live in student housing are getting it free of charge. Meanwhile, we've got an active outbreak at UCSB where they're using antibiotics to try and tamp it down, which is a good step, but they're not getting the same vaccines that Princeton
is. This is the University of California at Santa Barbara we're talking about, where there's a second outbreak going on. Yeah.
And there's a student out there who played lacrosse for UCSB who had his legs amputated last week. So, I mean, I just read this morning that he's moving his fingers, which is a tremendous sign. I can't tell you how happy I was when I read that. His parents posted it online. It looks like he's going to, you know, his hands are going to be okay, which will make his recovery much easier. But imagine, you know, being an athlete of that magnitude and then waking up and having somebody tell you, we need to amputate your legs.
Do we know why there are outbreaks like this? Are there theories, again, as to why this is going on?
College students, anybody who lives in a group situation, which obviously is often college students, 6 times more likely to get this disease than the general public.
Because
when you live with other people, you tend to pass bacteria around. Bacterial meningitis, it doesn't survive well in the air. It's not as contagious as the common cold. But if you share cups or glasses, silverware, even lip balm, I've heard of outbreaks traced to girls sharing lip balm. So anything where, you know, saliva from your throat can get into somebody else's throat. You know, there's a lot of kids at Princeton right now who are joking. Nobody's kissing at Princeton. Nobody's kissing at Princeton because of this. And, you know, it's funny, but it's also deadly serious.
But your point is the FDA should be approving this vaccine for use all across the country.
I mean, look, it's obviously safe enough for Princeton. So what's the holdup for the rest of us?
What's the FDA say about that? How are they justifying this?
If you go to the CDC's website, where the CDC is explaining what they're doing out there at Princeton, they said, you know, yes, Bexsero passed phase 2 clinical trials. Since then, the drug maker Novartis has had conversations with public health officials and has decided to try and license a comprehensive vaccine. They're trying to combine Bexsero with the current vaccines that protect against the other strains to develop a comprehensive vaccine for the main serogroups of bacterial meningitis. But that obviously sets back the process. So we've got the MenB shot right now that, you know, it seems to be a cost-benefit thing. You know, they're trying to combine it into one shot for efficiency's sake, and I get that. That makes total sense, and having one shot is appealing. But why not allow people the opportunity to weigh the costs versus the risks of death, brain damage, limb loss, and decide for themselves whether that's a shot that they want to get?
Andy Marceau is a reporter for the Topeka Capital Journal. We're talking about his battle with bacterial meningitis. What was your single darkest moment, Andy? As you look back on your battle, what was the moment where you were saying, maybe it's time to cash in my chips?
Right. So after I got out of the burn unit, I was in
the burn unit. Explain why you'd be in the burn unit.
Because all that dead tissue on my arms and legs because of the loss of circulation. I had the equivalent of third-degree burns over 30% of my body when I woke up from my medically induced coma. So I spent 3 months in the burn unit. And then when I was in the inpatient rehab unit, just trying to get strong enough to leave the hospital, they let you go home for a day. And in my case, home was an apartment near the hospital that my parents had moved into because we're from Minnesota. And so I went to this apartment for this visit, and this was supposed to be the moment. You know, this was like, okay, this is back to normal life, because you have this idea in your head that you don't leave the hospital until you're better. And that was when it hit me. It was like, this is it. Like, this is my new life. Like, I don't get my hands and feet back when I leave the hospital. You know,
yeah,
everything is different. And that was when it hit me. And that night when I was back in my room in the inpatient rehab, I was just in the deepest, darkest depression, because that was when I really realized my old life is gone. I'm not getting that back.
How did your folks handle all this?
I mean, my parents were incredible, and I might get choked up talking about them. So, mm-hmm. They got the first flight down from Minnesota, and then, you know, my dad actually was never back for over a year. My mom went back briefly a couple times, but yeah, they were basically at my side, and my brothers too, my two brothers, my grandma. Every time I woke up in the hospital, one of them was at my bedside, and yeah, we got so much closer through the whole experience, really, I could not have gotten through it without them.
It's a great story. They're Minnesota people. They're good people.
Well, I think they're just, yeah, they're good people, and they just, they do what they have to do. And that's what my mom and dad would tell you, is that, you know, this is just what you have to do in that mm-hmm. situation. You just, you drop everything. You absolutely, you know, my mom closed her law practice. My dad took a year off work. My brother transferred schools from St. Cloud State to KU. My older brother took, you know, all of the time off he possibly could from his job at Motorola. My grandma, you know, who is, you know, in her 70s and with arthritis, and she was down there, you know, doing whatever she could.
Everybody just rallied.
Yeah. And my friends too, back both in Kansas and from Minnesota. And the people in the burn unit too, the people in the hospital, the staff, and it wasn't just the doctors. It was everybody from the nurses to the custodians. I mean, there was one, a guy who didn't speak English. He'd come in to empty the trash and he would, you know, take whoever's hand was in the room, and he'd pray over me in Spanish every time he came in. I mean, it was just, the support was amazing. And that's really one reason why I wanted to write the book, is in some ways it is just a really long love letter to all those people, saying, like, thank you for helping me get through this, and also for helping me find some greater good and greater meaning in this.
You know, one thing you talk about in the book, Andy, is this notion that when you finally did come out, you had to relearn everything, you know, and there's some video of you typing on a keyboard for your job at the Cap Journal, and walk us through that. You had to relearn what exactly?
Well, first of all, I had to relearn how to walk without toes, and, you know, so that was a process of going and several surgeries and going from, you know, a wheelchair to a forearm crutch to a cane to finally just being able to walk on my own.
What was tricky about that?
Balance. I mean, if you don't have toes, balance is super hard. And also,
that's,
you know,
why we have toes, right?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the braces help with that, but when I first started out, I was like a toddler, you know, I was kind of like swaying around, trying to find my center of balance, trying to figure it out again.
Is it second nature to you now?
Yeah, I mean, now it's fine. My balance is still not what it would have been before. But now, you know, I can walk fine long distances, miles at a time, and it's no problem. And I think, you know, I walk pretty normally, like most people wouldn't be able to tell. But, I mean, as far as my hands, you know, one of my goals when my occupational therapy first started was to be able to blow my nose. I couldn't even do that because I had to figure out how to operate things with just my right thumb and what was left of my right hand. And I just had this tiny nub of a left thumb, and so it was like a constant physics lesson for me. You know, when I'm picking something up, I got to think about mass and force and friction and all of that, and try and
buttons were really tough. Show some video. You have a doohickey that you use to put your button your shirts.
I mean, one of the first things that I realized was, you know, I'm going to need a button hook, because when I was in high school, I worked at a drugstore. And I remembered they had these little devices for people with arthritis that help you, you know, pull the button through the hole. And anything like that that's like fine motor stuff, it's very difficult, very tricky, and it takes a long time to master.
And it took you how long to sort of get going again? How many months were you talking about?
It was basically a year from the day I left the hospital in September of 2004 until I got back to work in mm-hmm. September of 2005. So it took me about a year. And even then, I was still walking with that crutch. So it took me a couple more months to kind of get fully ambulatory and everything. But I was back to work within a year of leaving the hospital.
And you're a reporter, which means typing.
Yeah, typing, and a lot of deadlines. And so, you know, a lot of people at the State House come up to me and they say, wow, I can't believe how fast you type. That's faster than I do with 10 fingers. And I'm like, look, if this is what you do every day for hours a day, you know, you'll naturally get better at it. I'm probably not as fast as I used to be. But what I like to tell people now is that my brain holds me back more than my hands when it comes to finishing my work. So.
Well, Andy, it's an absolutely incredible story. Thank you for coming in today and sharing with us. And by all means, best of luck in the future.
Well, thanks for having me. Get vaccinated and know the signs of this disease.
Sounds good. That's Andy Marceau. Again, his new book, Worth the Pain, How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed Me for the Better. Thanks again, man. So good to have you here. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.